Potster Podcast, where politics, religion, and history collide, and it's not always polite. When I was a sophomore in high school, I was in the junior varsity basketball team. Our small all-girls school was a basketball powerhouse. Our varsity basketball team went to divisional and state tournaments, and if I recall correctly, won state championships. A number of players got athletic scholarships, and I know of at least one, maybe more, who were able to make a great living playing overseas, where women's basketball has a stronger following. But the JV team was not the varsity team. We weren't any good, and to be honest, I was the worst player on a bad team. I was a short, chubby kid who couldn't run fast and wasn't athletically gifted. I wasn't a horrible shot, but I got anxious the few times I would get the ball so I never scored. The coach, a loud, athletic woman with a very foul mouth, who once thought it was cute to pretend to run me over with her car, my mom didn't like that, by the way, said that if we showed up to practice, we would play in the game. As the worst player, I would get maybe a couple minutes a game, but it was worth it for a 15-year-old me to feel part of something. That's why I liked sports. I sucked and I knew it. I was relatively self-aware at that age, but I was dedicated. I went to every practice. I endured the grueling suicides, drills, and runs along with my teammates, listened to the coach and didn't drink water until after practice, even though I was super thirsty, wheezing from my asthma, and could barely breathe. Today, it might be considered abusing your players. But back in the mid-90s, it was considered instilling toughness. We had been losing all of our games that season, just like the season before, except with a different coach. Then we had a home game. I can't remember who we played, but I do remember it being a home game. Everybody was there. It was so hype. It was the only game our team actually won. And the coach never put me in. I got benched. Everyone celebrated. I was happy for the team. I celebrated with them. But I didn't feel like I was part of it. It was one thing if we were a good team. It would be one thing if the coach never said we would play if we practiced. I may have felt bad anyway, but I could understand a bit more. But she did not honor her word. My dedication was good enough to be part of the losses, but not good enough to be part of the wins. And moreover, she never apologized for neglecting to put me in. I remember putting on the mask and congratulating my teammates. Then when I stepped into the hallway and got on the payphone to call my parents to have them pick me up from the game, I could no longer shield my disappointment. My parents didn't want me to quit because by doing so, they felt I would be handing the coach a victory. But I didn't want to dedicate my weekdays and weekends for something I wasn't going to be made a part of. Despite being a chubby kid, I played sports, basketball, soccer, track and field, volleyball, at various points since I was 7 years old. And when I quit Dominican's junior varsity basketball team, my sports playing days were completely over. When I think back, having the benefit of 20 years of hindsight and experience, would I do it all over again? I really don't know. It's the only major commitment I recall quitting in my life. And the JV basketball coach, who was also the varsity track and field coach, was fired later in the school year for unprofessional behavior, unrelated to my situation. Again, in the 90s, when the threshold for unprofessional behavior was a lot higher. On one hand, part of me can see where my parents were coming from. Don't let this woman force you out and kill your love for sports. But at the same time, by coming back, it would mean that what she did to me was okay. And I was putting my health on the line for the team when that dedication wasn't being honored. I think of that time in my life in light of the political climate right now and how much authorities, government authorities, entertainment and media authorities, and religious authorities are mired in it. Is winning worth compromising your morals, breaking your promises, and losing your soul? I'm your host, Jay Poole. Last episode, I discussed the case of movie mogul Harvey Weinstein, who has been accused of varying degrees of sexual abuse of over 60 actresses and other women who worked for him during the decades of him running Miramax and later the Weinstein Company. I also mentioned other figures from Hollywood, news media, and politics who have been accused of sexual misconduct. In that episode, I focus on these types of allegations and how we react to them within the framework of privilege. To hear more on that take, be sure to check out that episode. Now, since the episode, within the past couple of weeks, more allegations of sexual misconduct against famous figures have surfaced, including against actors Kevin Spacey and George Takei, comedian Louis C.K., and former state judge and current GOP candidate for U.S. Senator for the state of Alabama, Roy Moore. Roy Moore is an interesting case. Moore has been a longtime controversial figure in the state of Alabama. He's made claims that the September 11th attacks, as well as the Sandy Hook school shooting, were caused by the United States falling away from God. He's also stated a belief that Muslims should not be able to serve in Congress, and that Sharia law was being practiced in places like Illinois and Indiana without any evidence that this is indeed the case. Most recently, he falsely claimed that NFL players who are kneeling during the national anthem protesting police brutality are in violation of the law, stating, "This is law. If we disobey this, what else are we going to disobey?" He first rose to national prominence in the early 2000s because as Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, he had a nearly 3-ton monument of the Ten Commandments erected at the state courthouse. He was ordered by the federal government to have the monument removed as a violation of the First Amendment Religious Establishment Clause. He refused, as he claimed that it would violate his oath of office, as without the Christian God, there would be no ethics. So he was removed from his position for the rest of his elected term. Several years later, in 2012, he was re-elected. In 2015, Moore, a longtime opponent of LGBT rights, defied a federal court decision striking down Alabama's law against same-sex marriage by ordering state officials to ignore the federal court order. In 2016, after the U.S. Supreme Court handed down the decision in the Obergefell v. Hodges case, legalizing same-sex marriage nationally, Moore stated that the Obergefell decision was worse than Scott v. Sanford, the 1857 Supreme Court ruling stating that black people were not citizens and had no rights a white man was bound to respect. Moore issued an administrative order to lower state court judges, ordering them to ignore the Obergefell decision and continue a ban on issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. In response, the Alabama Court of Judiciary, the oversight body for state judges, ruled that Moore overstepped his authority, and because he would likely continue to defy federal injunctions and engage in other behavior afoul of the law and judicial ethics, he was removed again from office. After losing his appeal earlier this year to get his job back, he is now running for U.S. Senate to replace the vacancy left by Jeff Sessions, moving on to the U.S. Attorney General position. Donald Trump and many establishment Republicans endorsed his Republican primary opponent, Luther Strange. But Moore beat Strange in the GOP primary. He is now running against Doug Jones, a Democrat who, as U.S. attorney, successfully prosecuted members of the Ku Klux Klan who murdered 4 young girls in the racially motivated Birmingham church bombing in 1963. The special election for the U.S. Senate seat is December 12th. On Thursday, November 9th, The Washington Post ran a story where 4 women accused Moore of making sexual advances on them when they were teenagers back in the late 1970s, when he was an assistant district attorney in his 30s. One of the women was only 14 years old at the time, And she said that Moore offered to watch her while her mother went into the courtroom for a custody dispute. And this turned into two sexual encounters in his remote cabin. The legal age of consent was, at the time, and still is, 16 in Alabama. Another teen said he plied her with alcohol when she was under 19, the legal age to drink at the time in the state. There are more specific details and corroborating witnesses in the Washington Post story. I'll link to the story in the liner notes so you can read more. The important thing to note here is that these four women were all teenage girls at the time they accused Moore of sexual misconduct. None initiated contact with the Washington Post. Moore's behavior was apparently an open secret in Alabama, and when it was uncovered by the Post, they sought out not only these women, but witnesses that could support these women's stories. They were able to find 30 corroborating witnesses to these women's stories. So the story is journalistically solid and well-sourced. How has Moore responded? Here's part of an interview he did with Sean Hannity on Friday, November 10th.
Specifically, let's start with what they talked about, that you had struck up a conversation with this young woman who was 14, Lee Kaufman, and her mother says that you offered to watch the girl while the mother went inside for a custody hearing, which they confirmed it actually happened at that time. What is your, do you know Ms. Kaufman? Do you know the mother?
I don't know Ms. Kaufman from anybody. I never talked to her, never had any contact with her. Allegations of sexual misconduct with her are completely false. I believe they're politically motivated. I believe they're brought only to stop a very successful campaign, and that's what they're doing. I've never known this woman or anything with regard to the other girls. You understand this is 40 years ago, and after my return from the military, I dated a lot of young ladies. I do recognize, however, the names of two of these young ladies, Debbie Wesson and Gloria Thacker, which they have a maiden, that's their maiden name.
Well, let me just give the details. Debbie Wesson Gibson says she was 17 when you spoke to her high school civics class and asked her out on several dates, and it did not progress, her words, beyond kissing, according to the Washington Post. Let's stay on her. Did that happen?
I do not remember speaking to a civics class. I don't remember that. I do not remember when we, I seem to know, remember knowing her parents. That they were friends. I can't recall specific dates because that's been 40 years, but I remember, her as a good girl. But neither of them have ever stated any, inappropriate behavior. She didn't say anything that,
But do you remember ever going on a date with her? She said that you asked her out on the first of several dates, but nothing progressed beyond kissing.
I don't remember specific dates. No, I do not. And I don't remember if it was in that time or later, but I do not remember that. No.
But you know her, but you never dated her ever. Is that what you're saying?
Know her, but I don't remember going out on dates. I knew her as a friend. If we did go on dates, then we did, but I do not remember that.
What about Gloria Thacker Deason? Says she was an 18-year-old cheerleader when you began taking her on dates that included bottles of Matus Rosé wine. She's 18 at the time. The Alabama drinking age at the time is 19. Did that ever happen?
No, because in this county, it's a dry county. We never would have had liquor if I would never... And I believe this, she said that she believed she was underage. And she, as I recall, she was 19 or older. And that just never happened. I never provided alcohol, beer, or intoxicating liquors to a minor. That would be against the law, against anything I would have ever done. And I seem to remember her as a good girl. I seem to remember that I had some sort of knowledge of her parents or mother very in particular.
At that time in your life, let me ask you this. You do remember these girls. Would it be unusual for you as a 32-year-old guy to have dated a woman as young as 17? That would be a, 15-year difference, or a girl 18. Do you remember dating girls that young at that time?
Not generally, no. If I did, I'm not going to dispute anything, but I don't remember anything like that.
Pot Stirrer Podcast will be back after this. Did you know for today's episode? During and since the 2016 presidential election, Donald Trump has claimed that millions of illegal votes were cast favoring his opponent Hillary Clinton. This charge echoes a similar rationale many Republicans have made in support of laws making it more difficult for Americans who already suffer from low rates of turnout in elections to exercise their right to vote. The rationale being that many fraudulent votes are cast for Democratic candidates and they aim to protect the integrity of the vote. This runs counter to the fact that voter fraud is extremely rare, and a few times it has been uncovered, it has most often been Republicans engaging in it. But the voter fraud narrative persists and is used to support onerous voter identification laws that disproportionately affect the poor, the elderly, and people of color. The narrative has also been used to support the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, a commission that some charge is designed to increase voter suppression and further raise barriers to citizens exercising their rights to vote. But did you know that the Election Integrity Commission is now being sued by one of its own members? According to ProPublica, Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap, a commissioner on the ostensibly bipartisan commission, has charged that the commission has violated the Federal Advisory Commission Act, which requires, among other things, that commissions such as this one be bipartisan and transparent. Dunlap accuses the Republican leadership of intentionally excluding him from deliberations, restricting his access to commission documents needed to carry out his role on the commission, and not inviting the public to participate. He says that he is reluctantly filing the suit after having sent multiple unanswered letters to the commission leadership alerting them to his grievances. Part of the suit includes the decision of Kris Kobach, the commission leader and Kansas Secretary of State, to send a letter to all states requesting publicly available voter rolls. According to Dunlap, Kobach failed to consult other commissioners before deciding, along with two Republicans who had not yet joined the commission, to send this controversial letter. Kobach responded to the news of Dunlap's suit, calling it baseless and paranoid, but did not fully refute that they had excluded Dunlap from communications, stating that he had not been excluded between September 12th and October 17th. Though Dunlap's claims primarily focus on a period prior to that time window, for example, the letter incident was back in June. The commission has now been sued 8 times while only meeting 2 times. What a start. Now, back to Potstirrer Podcast. The Republican Party is in a seemingly difficult position. The U.S. Senate is closely divided right now, 52-48. Every Senate seat counts. Because the election is a month away, it's too late to remove Moore from the ballot. If Moore wins, which at this point is very likely in a deeply red state where Trump won by about 26%, they have the Senate seat, which helps keep them in control of the Senate. But getting behind his candidacy also taints them with the fact that they are supporting an accused child sexual predator. Republican reactions have generally fallen into 3 categories. The first one, Roy Moore did it and he should bow out of the U.S. Senate race. The second is less committal. If Roy Moore did it, he should step aside. The third, Roy Moore didn't do it, and even if he did, it's really not that bad, or at least not as bad as the prospect of electing a Democrat. The first category seems to be a bit sparse. Former presidential candidate Mitt Romney. innocent until proven guilty is for criminal convictions, not elections. I believe Lee Korfman, the then 14-year-old accuser. Her account is too serious to ignore. Moore is unfit for office and should step aside. Senator John McCain. The allegations against Roy Moore are deeply disturbing and disqualifying. He should immediately step aside and allow the people of Alabama to elect a candidate they are proud of. But most of John McCain's Republican colleagues fall into the second category, not committing to a position on Moore while attempting to sound like they are taking a stand against his behavior. So, kind of lukewarm. Here are a couple of examples. Senator Jeff Flake. If there's any shred of truth to the allegations against Roy Moore, he should step aside immediately. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. If these allegations are true, he must step aside. Vice President Mike Pence. Senators Lisa Murkowski, Ted Cruz, John Cornyn, David Perdue, Richard Shelby, Mike Lee, Pat Toomey, Tim Scott, Cory Gardner, John Hooven, Susan Collins, and Rob Portman all made similar statements. The problem is, the if true statement is a cop-out. And let me tell you why. These cases will never make it into a court of law. The statute of limitations ran out a long time ago. And as educated folks, primarily lawyers and business people by profession, these politicians surely know it. With no possibility of a trial, they will never have to put their real thoughts on the record and risk angering anyone who might make them pay at the ballot box. For the vice president and so many GOP senators to take this position, it is the ultimate in cowardice. And about that third category. Daniel Dale, a reporter for the Toronto Star, attempted to reach out to multiple Republican Party officials in the state of Alabama and received some rather candid answers, which Dale shared on Twitter. Here are just a few of these. Alabama Bibb County Republican Chairman Jerry Powell tells me he'd vote for Roy Moore even if Moore did commit a sex crime against a girl. I would vote for Judge Moore because I wouldn't want to vote for Doug. I'm not saying I support what he did. This same GOP officer who vote Moore even if he was a proven sex offender refused in 2015 to accept the legalization of gay marriage, saying, it's wrong. Another one. It was 40 years ago, Alabama Marion County GOP Chair David Hall tells me. I really don't see the relevance of it. He was 32, she was supposedly 14, she's not saying that anything happened other than they kissed. Dale says, the story said she tried to get her to touch his genitals. Hall, but, well, she said he may have tried to, but we're talking something that somebody said happened 40 years ago. It wouldn't affect whether or not I vote for him. The other women that they're using to corroborate, number one was 19, one was 17, one was 16. There's nothing wrong with a 30-year-old single male asking a 19-year-old, a 17-year-old, or a 16-year-old out on a date. Alabama Covington County GOP Chairman William Blocker. Blocker tells me he'd consider voting Moore even if hard proof of sexual abuse emerged. There is no option to support Doug Jones, the Democratic nominee. When you do that, you are supporting the entire Democrat Party. Another one. Other than being with an underage person, he didn't really force himself. Alabama Geneva County GOP Chairman Riley Siebenhenner tells me, I know that's bad enough, but I don't know. If he withdraws, it's 5 weeks to the election. That would concede it to the Democrat. Siebenhenner says he doesn't believe the allegations are true, but if they're true, he won't support him, but at the same time, it's not forcible rape. I know that 14-year-olds don't make good decisions. The same party that has taken on support for transgender bathroom bills, stating that they are worried about grown men dressed as women going into women's restrooms and preying on young girls. The same party that has spoken out against LGBT rights in general, stating that they worry about the effect it would have on the children, is willing to defend the actions of a man accused of preying upon teenage girls, including a 14-year-old, even blaming the child for not making good decisions. This has nothing to do with conservatism or their version of morality. It's about winning. And winning is more important than morality. Christian conservative leader Jerry Falwell Jr. has come to Roy Moore's defense as well, stating, "It comes down to a question, who is more credible in the eyes of the voters, the candidate or the accuser? And I believe the judge is telling the truth. I don't believe this kind of story would change support for him among Christians, since he has categorically denied it. Most will see it as dirty politics." Most infamously, Alabama State Auditor Jim Ziegler invokes the Bible to support Roy Moore. In an interview with the Washington Examiner, he states that Moore is, quote, "clean as a hound's tooth." Take the Bible. Zechariah and Elizabeth, for instance. Zechariah was extremely old to marry Elizabeth, and they became the parents of John the Baptist. Also take Joseph and Mary. Mary was a teenager, and Joseph was an adult carpenter. They became parents of Jesus. There's just nothing immoral or illegal here, maybe just a little bit unusual. Again, the age of consent at the time and today in the state of Alabama is 16. Also, the Bible does not speak specifically to Mary or Joseph's age. And let's not forget that according to the Bible, Mary was a virgin when pregnant with Jesus. There was no sexual impropriety. Mary was not being taken by a DA in his 30s to a cabin in the woods. Ed Stetzer, Wheaton College professor and executive director of the Billy Graham Center, wrote an op-ed for Christianity Today and took Ziegler's comments head-on. Now, Stetzer is cautious not to necessarily assume Moore's guilt, but he does have some pointed words regarding Ziegler's comments. Stetzer says, "Christians don't use Joseph and Mary to explain child molesting accusations." Note that Ziegler actually presumes guilt, but justifies it by pointing to the Bible. Stetzer says of Ziegler's comments, "So let's be clear. No normal evangelical believes this about the Bible." Stetzer goes on to say, "As Christians, this should provoke anger. We should be angered. First, that politicians think they can lie to us so easily by appealing to biblical language and characters. Second, that we so easily fall for such tactics. For the past decade, evangelicals have been easy marks, and I hope that people won't fall for these things. Yes, in case you were wondering, there may have been an age difference between Joseph and Mary, and there were customs then that we don't follow now. But they were married, not molested." Stetzer then makes this point, which I think is very important. In the midst of an avalanche of accusations against liberal Hollywood that we accept immediately as truth, let's not brush aside an accusation against a religious right leader. We need to take allegations seriously on all sides of the political aisle. In other words, let's not dismiss allegations against people in power just because they are powerful figures we like. Over 80% of white evangelical voters supported Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election, even though he has filed for bankruptcy several times, has repeatedly cheated his contractors, was twice divorced, and cheated on his wives, has had his share of sexual assault allegations leveled against him, and even bragged about fondling women on the Access Hollywood tape. For most white evangelical voters, personal morality was no longer as important as winning. And many pundits believe that despite the allegations against Roy Moore, he will win in heavily evangelical and heavily Republican Alabama. And I think they're right. The narrative being spun in these circles is similar to the ones spun to defend other conservatives who find themselves in hot water. The Washington elites, the deep state, the world, the devil, you name it, is out to get an upstanding man, and yes, it's usually a man, who has fought on the side of conservative Christianity for years. In a state that is heavily Republican and usually considered a safe seat for the GOP. Okay. When you worship power, there's no longer room for Jesus. The bottom line is, an accused child molester will likely beat out a man who stood up to the Ku Klux Klan in the state of Alabama because for too many Republicans and evangelical Christians alike, winning is more important than their words. Alabama, please prove me wrong. Check out our website today, PotSwearerPodcast.com, for previous episodes, special presentations, announcements, merch, and all things PotStirrer Podcast. You can find our show on iTunes, Google Play, and most other podcatchers. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, give us 5 stars, leave a review, share, and tell your friends. Thank you for listening and supporting PotStirrer Podcast. I'm Jay Poole. Let's fight for America's future, because freedom is not free.